The Cannabis Question by Ken Olson. Some veterans say medical marijuana could reduce painkiller addictions and curb the suicide rate. Is it a crime or a cure? Anna Begin spent 5 years worrying she would get a phone call telling her that her son had killed himself. After Ryan came home from Iraq with his right elbow blown off, he went on benders, wrecked 2 trucks, was jailed, disappeared for weeks, and tried to commit suicide several times. It was an absolute living hell, Anna says. Being around Ryan, who served in the Marine Corps, wasn't much better. The cocktail of narcotic painkillers, anti-anxiety medications, antidepressants, and sleeping pills prescribed first by the military and then VA made him violent and unpredictable. When he was on that medication, he would have a wild look in his eyes, Anna says. I never worried about him hurting anyone else, but you never knew when he was going to spark up in a temper or sleep all day and then be up all night. We couldn't hold family functions here because his mood would be all over the place. It was a rough road, Ryan concedes. I don't know why I am alive. After 5 years of this ordeal, he found a private physician about 2 hours from his home in Jackman, Maine, who prescribed medical marijuana and meditation instead of prescription drugs. Dr. Sulak and medical marijuana saved my son's life, Anna says. Ryan can openly use cannabis to alleviate his pain and post-traumatic stress because Maine is one of 23 states that has legalized medical marijuana, part of a dramatic change in national attitudes that is fraught with legal and regulatory conflicts, controversy about marijuana's medical viability, and a catch-22 that has all but prohibited research into the potential healing properties of marijuana. It's also a change that is likely here to stay. A recent Pew Research Center poll found that 52% of Americans support legalizing marijuana. It's partly a cultural shift on what a drug is, says Jim Moore, director of the Tom McCall Center for Policy Innovation at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. More people believe marijuana is less harmful than alcohol and no longer view cannabis as a gateway to harsher illegal drug use, he says. Many fiscal conservatives are also weary of the cost of the drug war. FBI statistics show that marijuana accounts for nearly half of all drug arrests in the United States, Moore says. Likewise, half of the people behind bars on drug charges were imprisoned for marijuana offenses. The incarceration costs for drug crimes are enormous, he adds. Public acceptance of marijuana has been building for decades. Oregon was the first state to decriminalize possession of pot in 1973. By 1978, 8 other states, including Alaska, North Carolina, and Ohio, had followed suit. Nearly 20 years later, California led the nation in decriminalizing medical marijuana, and in the past 2 years, Colorado, Washington, Alaska, and Oregon legalized recreational use of marijuana. In addition, the spending bill approved by Congress in December prohibits the U.S. Justice Department and the Drug Enforcement Agency from interfering with state medical marijuana laws. National legalization is inevitable, although it may take 20 years, Moore predicts. We're moving toward a critical mass, he says. States, in effect, are going to force the federal government's hand. They either have to change how they enforce things, how they interpret the current law, or wholesale rewrite the federal drug laws, tax policy, and banking laws. As that showdown lingers, there's a growing clash between veterans who want the option of using medical marijuana and VA, which prohibits its physicians from discussing the topic even in states where medical marijuana is legal. Veterans also report losing medical care when VA learns they are using marijuana, a fear that has effectively driven most use underground. I call it the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, says Michael Krawitz, an Air Force veteran and executive director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. I tell veterans to shut up. VA faces a dilemma. Federal law classifies marijuana as a Schedule I narcotic with no recognized medical use and a high risk of addiction. Its doctors can't talk pot because federal employees must comply with federal law, says VA spokeswoman Gina Jackson. VA acknowledges that veterans who use marijuana may lose access to some medical care. In some cases, participation in state marijuana programs may be inconsistent with treatment goals, and therefore treatment plans may be modified accordingly for the health of the patient, Jackson adds. Some members of Congress want to unsnarl this conflict, a bipartisan coalition that includes U.S. Representatives Earl Blumenauer, Democrat, Oregon, and Dana Rohrabacher, Republican, California, has introduced legislation that authorizes VA physicians to recommend marijuana as a treatment option in states where it's legal. Our antiquated drug laws must catch up with the real suffering of so many of our veterans, Rohrabacher says. It is unconscionable that a VA doctor cannot offer a full range of treatments, including medical marijuana. But Congress has sent mixed messages on marijuana. The December legislation that prohibited federal law enforcement from interfering with state medical marijuana laws also blocked a voter initiative legalizing recreational marijuana use in Washington, D.C., and Congress previously blocked the district's voter-approved medical marijuana initiative. As marijuana hangs in this legal limbo, former service members contend that narcotic painkillers, sleeping pills, amphetamines, antidepressants, and drugs they are being prescribed are dangerous if not lethal. With 22 veteran suicides a day, it's clear we don't know what we're doing, says Sean Kiernan, an Army veteran who had his own brush with suicide after being treated with prescription drugs. Other veterans say the status quo pharmaceuticals leave them stupefied. Shortly after I got out, I started experiencing symptoms of PTSD, says Sean Azzariti, who served two tours in Iraq with the Marine Corps. I was prescribed trazodone, clonopin, and Adderall, 13 pills total a day. I was just becoming an unfunctional human being. Some physicians acknowledge the downside of conventional treatment. Doctors like me have put patients through the gauntlet with FDA-approved drugs, and we've turned these patients into zombies, says Sue Sisley, a psychiatrist in private practice in Arizona who treats veterans, police officers, and firefighters. They are plagued with the side effects. The narcotic painkillers commonly prescribed to veterans are also highly addictive and can lead to overdose deaths, says Iraq veteran Scott Murphy, founder of Veterans for Safe Access and Compassionate Care. Medical marijuana can help veterans reduce their opiate dependence and leads to fewer suicides, Murphy and many other veterans and marijuana advocacy groups contend. Several veterans I'm close with had severe PTSD issues and suicidal tendencies when they came home, says Kerry Babbitt, an Army reservist who deployed to Afghanistan as an MP. Many have successfully used medical marijuana to treat their symptoms, she adds. If you are willing to give someone a dangerous drug like an opiate, it seems insane not to give them a less dangerous option, Murphy adds, and this would be under a doctor's supervision. There is little research to back the use of medical marijuana to reduce opiate dependence. However, a recent study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, shows that states with legal access to medical marijuana had fewer painkiller overdose deaths. We found a 25% lower rate of opiate overdose deaths in states that had enacted medical marijuana laws, says Marcus Bachhuber, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation clinical scholar at the University of Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. We were surprised by the magnitude of the result, he says, of the study, which examined narcotic painkiller overdoses from 1999 to 2010. That's significant, considering that use of narcotic painkillers quadrupled in the United States during the years Bachhuber studied. In addition, 60% of the people who died from painkiller overdoses had legal prescriptions for those drugs, but the study doesn't conclusively credit marijuana for reducing the rate of fatal painkiller overdoses. We think this might be due in part to other things states are doing to address opioid overdoses, like educating medical providers or educating the public, Bachhuber says. We need large studies that follow individuals with chronic pain over time and evaluate the effect of medical marijuana on their pain. The skeptics include Anthony Dragovich, a former Army pain specialist now in private practice in Virginia. There's no evidence marijuana would decrease narcotic painkiller dependence, he says. Actual experience would hint otherwise. He likewise doubts that marijuana lowers the risk of suicide. There is some evidence it works for pain, nausea, emesis, vomiting, and some neurological conditions, Dragovich says, but it isn't well studied. I would be very concerned about using medical marijuana as a cure for anything rather than part of an intensive psychological rehabilitation program for patients with significant PTSD. A study that followed 80 veterans in New Mexico, one of the states that has legalized medical marijuana, found a 75% decrease in PTSD symptoms, Sisley says. But additional research on the effectiveness of medical marijuana is all but impossible because of federal regulations. There are so many barriers that no other Schedule I drug has to face, she says. Last spring, Sisley won approval for another study using medical marijuana to treat PTSD after a 4-year fight with the National Institute on Drug Abuse and other agencies. She promptly lost her job at the University of Arizona, where she planned to conduct the research. They could never deal with the optics of having veterans smoking marijuana on campus, she says. That would have been a media frenzy. The university says it cannot comment on Sisley's departure because it's a personnel matter. The institution would have hosted the project with a different chief scientist, a university spokesman said. Sisley now plans to split her study between Johns Hopkins University and another as-yet-unnamed research institution. I think we have a duty to these veterans to study this drug in the most rigorous way, she says. It's possible the plant could be a detriment. We'll be able to collect the data on the good and the bad and put it out there for public scrutiny. It's important to note that Sisley came to this work opposed to cannabis. She chastised veterans who first told her they were using medical marijuana to treat their PTSD. I tried to persuade them to use conventional methods, she says, but there were more and more high-ranking conservative veterans who hated street drugs who were using medical marijuana. Sisley has also been persuaded to dig deeper as a result of the anecdotal evidence showing that cannabis helps address sleep problems. Sleep deprivation is particularly brutal for veterans with PTSD, she says. People who live with chronic sleep deprivation are at high risk to end their life. If marijuana could help stabilize these symptoms, it might curb the suicide epidemic. Still, physicians, patients, and families are careful to say cannabis isn't a universal cure. Even Ryan Began's mother is ambivalent about recreational marijuana. But watching her son get control of his life convinced her that medical marijuana should be available to veterans and civilians dealing with chronic pain and post-traumatic stress. Ryan credits his family and friends for helping him get off prescription pills and connect with the right physician and with medical marijuana. Now I'm in a position, physically and mentally, where I can help other vets, he says. He won custody of his 8-year-old daughter a year ago. He remarried in September. Today he's looking at buying a home. I'm amazed at how far he's come, Anna says. For me, it's like winning the lottery. States struggle to tame new marijuana economy. Highly explosive hash oil operations popping up in residential neighborhoods, figuring out who's driving under the influence of pot, a spike in edible marijuana overdoses. These are a few of the reasons Colorado law enforcement officers feel overwhelmed by the dramatic increase in legal access to marijuana in recent years. We were taken by surprise, says Mark Vasquez, marijuana issues chairman for the Colorado Association of Chiefs of Police, CACP. I don't think we thought we would end up where we are today. Medical marijuana was relatively low-key when Colorado voters passed a constitutional amendment legalizing medicinal use in 2000. For the next decade, the number of registered medical cannabis users held steady at about 5,000. Then a lawsuit verdict overturned limits on the number of patients a marijuana caregiver could oversee, effectively repealing limits on medical pot cultivation. That caused things to really take off, says Vasquez, former chief of enforcement for the Colorado Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division. We saw the opening of commercial medical marijuana dispensaries with no regulatory framework. In 2012, Colorado voters approved an amendment legalizing recreational marijuana. State and local law enforcement have been playing catch-up ever since, Vasquez says. Among the problems, sorting out which drivers have had too much to drink and which have had too much to smoke. Money is a factor, too. It costs about $30 to administer an alcohol test and about $300 to test for marijuana use, he adds. The issues are so pressing that the CACP hosted a national symposium on marijuana in January. Meanwhile, Vasquez offers this advice. If your state faces the legalization of medical or recreational marijuana, try to get the regulatory framework in place before dispensaries and commercial cultivations are allowed to operate. Regulators are a little farther ahead of the game in Washington state, where voters also approved recreational marijuana use in 2012. There's money built into the program to monitor and mitigate some of the potential social costs of legalization, including tracking marijuana consumption among youth. As many people on the law enforcement side backed the initiative as opposed it, says Chris Marr, a former state liquor control board member and former state senator. The subtext there is that the war on drugs has failed. Other supporters see marijuana taxes as a means of funding schools and public safety. The rollout of Washington's marijuana programs hasn't been flawless. Medical marijuana, legalized by voters in 1998, is largely unregulated. There are now large-scale growing and selling operations in Seattle that are essentially for-profit businesses competing with state-licensed recreational pot stores, Marr says. Washington's medical marijuana is also taxed at a lower rate than recreational marijuana. That makes it harder to persuade cannabis consumers to buy from legitimate dealers. It's a price-sensitive market, Marr says. Our consultant told us, after our first year of operation, we would probably capture 25% of the market, and the rest would be split between the medical and the illicit market. Stores in the Evergreen State officially started selling recreational pot in July. As of November, Washington had collected about $16 million in excise, sales, and business taxes from pot. That could rise to an estimated $375 million in the 2015 to 2017 biennium, according to state revenue forecasters. Meanwhile, the Washington legislature is expected to try to get the medical marijuana industry under better control. Regulating that and other aspects of the new marijuana economy won't be easy. But Marr isn't discouraged. It took years following the repeal of prohibition to get the alcohol industry there. Marijuana is no different. It's like a wild horse, he says. You won't throw a saddle on it right away without having problems.